Chapter 30. A southbound work train, returning hundreds of exhausted men for 3 days' recuperation after 4 straight weeks of work, was sidelined to let a northbound materials train through. They were waiting to climb the Diamond Canyon Loop, a sweeping switchback curve 50 miles south of Tunnel 13. The siding had been gouged out of the canyon wall at the foot of a steep slope, and the sweep of the switchback allowed a clear view of the tracks running parallel high above them. What the men saw next would haunt them for the rest of their lives. The locomotive hauling the long string of boxcars and gondolas was a heavy 280 consolidation. She was a mountain-climbing workhorse with 8 drive wheels. On this light grade, etched from the side of the canyon, the coupling rods that linked her drivers were a blur of swift motion as she entered the curve at nearly 40 miles an hour. Few of the weary slumped on the hard benches of the sidelined work train below took much notice, but those who did look up saw her smoke flatten behind her as she raced high above them. One even remarked to a dozing friend, "She's eyeballing like old man Hennessy's got his hand on the throttle." The 280's engine truck, the short, stabilizing front wheels that prevented swaying at such speed, screeched as they pressed against the curve. Her engineer knew the run to the cutoff like the back of his hand, and this particular bend on the lip of Diamond Canyon was one spot he did not want to hear the screech of a loose rail. "Don't like that noise one bit," he started to say to his fireman. In the next millisecond, long before he could finish the sentence, much less throttle back, the 120-ton locomotive's lead drive wheel hit the loose rail. The rail parted from the ties with a loud bang. Free of the wooden ties that held them a hard and fast 4 feet 8.5 inches apart, the tracks spread. All 4 drive wheels on the outside of the curb dropped off the steel, and the locomotive charged straight ahead at 40 miles an hour, spraying crushed stone, splintered wood, and broken spikes. To the men watching from the work train sidelined at the bottom of the canyon, it looked as if the freight hurtling overhead had developed a mind of its own and decided to fly. Years later, survivors would swear that it soared for an amazingly long way before gravity took charge. Several found religion, convinced that God had intervened to help the freight train fly just far enough that most of it overshot the work train when it tumbled down the mountain. At the time, however, what most saw when they looked up at the terrible thunder was a 280 consolidation locomotive toppling off the edge of a cliff and rolling at them with 50 boxcars and gondolas that swept trees and boulders from the slope like a long black whip. Most remembered the noise. It started as thunder, swelled to the roar of an avalanche, and ended, hours later it seemed, in the sharp, rending clatter of steel and wood raining down on the stationary work train. None forgot the fear. Isaac Bell was on the scene within hours. He wired Hennessy that the wreck was very possibly an accident. There was no evidence that the wrecker had tampered with the rails. Admittedly, the heavy consolidation had so battered the point where she jumped the track that it was impossible to distinguish for sure between deliberate removal of spikes or an accidental loose rail. But meticulously filed Southern Pacific Railway police reports indicated that patrols on horseback and handcar had blanketed the area. It was unlikely, Bell concluded, that the saboteur could have gotten close enough to strike at the Diamond Canyon Loop. Livid because the wreck had unsettled his workforce, Hennessy sent Franklin Mowry, the civil engineer he had hauled out of retirement to build the Cascade Canyon Bridge, to inspect the wreck. Mowry limped along the ruined bed, leaning heavily on his bespectacled assistant's arm. He was a talkative old man. Born, he told Bell, in 1837, when Andrew Jackson was still president. He said he had been present when the first Continental Railroad linked east and west lines at Promontory Point, Utah, in 1869. "Nearly 40 years ago. Time flies. Hard to believe I was even younger that day than this rascal helping me walk." He gave his assistant an affectionate slap on the shoulder. Eric Soares, whose wire-rimmed glasses, wavy dark hair, expressive eyes, broad brow, narrow chin, and thin waxed handlebar mustache made him look more like a poet or a painter than a civil engineer, returned a sly smile. "What do you think, Mr. Mowry?" asked Bell. "Was it an accident?" "Hard to say, son. Ties smashed like kindling, no piece large enough to register tua marks. Spikes bent or snapped in two. Reminds me of a derailment I saw back in 83. String of passenger cars descending the High Sierra, the rear cars telescoping into one another like that caboose over there rammed inside that boxcar." The tall detective and the two engineers cast sober eyes on the caboose stuffed into the boxcar like a hastily packed suitcase. "What will you report to Mr. Hennessy?" Bell asked. Mowry nudged Eric Soares. "What should we tell him, Eric?" Soares removed his glasses, glanced about myopically, then dropped to his knees and closely examined a cross-tie severed by a locomotive drive wheel. "As you say, Mr. Mowry," he said, "if they did pull spikes, no tua marks survived." "But," Mowry said, "I'd venture the old man is not going to want to hear that slack maintenance was the culprit, is he, Eric?" "No, Mr. Mowry," Eric answered with another of his sly smiles. Their friendship, Bell noticed, seemed based on Mowry acting like an uncle and Soares the favorite nephew. "Nor will he welcome speculation that hasty construction could have resulted in a weakness exploited by the fast-moving heavy locomotive, will he, Eric?" "No, Mr. Mowry." "Compromise, Mr. Bell, is the essence of engineering. We surrender one thing to get another. Build too fast, we get shabby construction. Build too scrupulously, we never get the job done." Eric stood up, hooked his glasses around his ears again, and took up the older's chant. "Build it so strong that it will never fail, we risk building too heavy. Build it light, we might build it too weak." "Herrick's a metallurgist," Mowry said, chuckling. "Speaking of essence, he knows 40 types of steel that didn't even exist in my day." Bell was still studying the telescoped wreckage of the caboose stuffed inside the boxcar when an intriguing idea struck him. These men were engineers. They understood how things were made. "Could you make a sword that starts short and gets longer?" he asked.
"Beg your pardon?"
"You were talking about telescoping in steel, and I was wondering whether the blade of a sword could be hidden inside itself, then extended to make it long."
"Like a collapsible stage sword?" asked Mowry. "Where the actor appears to be run through, but the blade actually retracts into itself."
"Only this one would not retract. It would run you through." "What do you say, Eric? You studied metallurgy at Cornell. Could you make such a sword?"
"You can make anything if you've got the money," Eric answered.
"But it would be difficult to make it strong."
"Strong enough to run a man through?"
"Easily strong enough to thrust. Strong enough to pierce flesh. But it could not endure lateral impact."
"Lateral impact?"
Mowry explained. "Eric means that it would not stand up to whacking it sideways in a real sword fight against a real sword."
"The beat," said Bell. "A sharp blow to push your opponent's blade aside."
"You compromise strength in the interest of compactness. Two or three short lengths of steel joined cannot be as strong as one."
"Why do you ask, Mr. Bell?"
"I was curious what it would be like to make a knife turn into a sword," said Bell.
"Surprising," Mowry said dryly, "to the fellow on the business end."
The bridge builder took a final look around and steadied himself on Eric's arm.
"Let's go, Eric. No putting it off any longer. I've got to report to the old man exactly what Mr. Bell reported, which is exactly what the old man doesn't want to hear. Who the heck knows what happened? But we found no evidence of sabotage."
When Mowry did make his report,
An angry Osgood Hennessy asked in a low, dangerous voice, "Was the engineer killed?" "Barely a scratch. He must be the luckiest locomotive driver alive." "Fire him. If it wasn't radical sabotage, then excessive speed caused that wreck. That'll show the hands I don't tolerate reckless engineers risking their lives." But firing the engineer did nothing to calm the terrified workmen employed to finish the Cascades cutoff. Whether the wreck had been an accident or the work of a saboteur, they didn't care. Although they were inclined to believe that the wrecker had struck again, police spies reported that there was talk in the camp of a strike. "Strike!" echoed the apoplectic Hennessy. "I'm paying them top dollar. What the hell else do they want?" "They want to go home," Isaac Bell explained. He was keeping close track of the men's mood by polling his covert operatives in the cookhouses and saloons and visiting personally to gauge the effect of the wrecker's attacks on the Southern Pacific labor force. "They're afraid to ride the work train." "That's insane. I'm about to haul through the last tunnel to the bridge." "They say that the cutoff has become the most dangerous line in the West." Ironically, Bell admitted, the wrecker had won this round, whether he intended to or not. The old man dropped his head in his hands. "God in heaven, where am I going to get 1,000 men with winter coming?" He looked up angrily. "Round up their ringleaders. Clap a bunch in jail. The rest will come around." "May I suggest," said Bell, "a more productive course?" "No. I know how to crush a strike." He turned to Lillian, who was watching him intently. "Get me Jethro Watt, and wire the governor. I want troops here by morning."
"Sir," said Bell, "I've just come back from the camp." It's gripped with fear. Watt's police will at best provoke a riot and at worst cause vast numbers to drift away. Troops will make it even worse. You can't force decent work out of frightened men, but you can attempt to alleviate their fright.
"What do you mean?"
"Bring in Jethro Watt. Bring 500 officers with him. But put them to work patrolling the line. Blanket it until it is apparent that you, not the wrecker, control every inch of track between here and Tunnel 13.
"That'll never work," said Hennessy. "Those agitators won't buy it. They just want to strike."
Lillian spoke up at last.
"Try it, Father."
And so the old man did. Within a day, every mile of track was guarded and every mile scoured for loose rails and buried explosives. Just as had happened in Jersey City, where Van Dorn operatives had arrested various criminals swept up in the search for the wrecker's accomplices, here, in the course of hunting for signs of sabotage, track crews discovered several weaknesses in the track and repaired them. Bell mounted a horse and rode the 20-mile line. He returned by locomotive, satisfied that this newest stretch of the cutoff had been transformed from the most dangerous in the West to the best maintained, and the best guarded. The wrecker drove a trader's wagon pulled by two strong mules. It had a patched and faded canvas top stretched over 7 hoops. Under the canvas were pots and pans and woolen cloth, salt, a barrel of lard, another that held china dishes packed in straw. Hidden under the trader's cargo was an 8-foot-long, 10-by-12-inch freshly milled mountain hemlock railroad tie. The trader was dead, stripped naked and tossed off a hillside. He was nearly as tall as the wrecker, and his clothes fit the wrecker reasonably well. A hole bored the length of the squared timber was stuffed with dynamite. The wrecker followed a buggy road that likely had started out as an Indian trail long before the railroad was built, and a mule deer track before then. While steep and narrow, the road unerringly found the gentlest slopes in a land that was harsh. Most of the remote settlements it touched upon were abandoned. Those that weren't, he avoided. Their hard-scrabble residents might recognize the wagon
and wonder what had happened to its owner. Here and there the road crossed the new railroad, offering an opportunity to drive the wagon onto the tracks. But every time he neared the cutoff line, he saw patrols, police riding horseback, and police pumping handcars. His plan was to drive his wagon along the tracks at night to the edge of a deep canyon, where he would replace an in-place cross tie with his explosive one. But as afternoon waned and the slopes darkened, he was forced to admit that his plan would not succeed. Isaac Bell's hand was obvious in the precautions, and the wrecker cursed yet again the killers he had hired in Rawlins who had botched the job. But all his cursing and all his regretting would not change the fact that Bell's patrols meant that he could not risk driving the wagon on the tracks. The railroad cut was narrow. Much of it consisted of sheer rock on one side and a steep drop on the other. If he ran into a patrol, there was no place to hide a wagon, and in most places, no way to drive it off the tracks at all. The hemlock crosstie weighed 200 pounds. The spike puller he needed to remove an existing tie weighed 20. The puller could double as a crowbar to dig out the ballast, but he couldn't drive spikes with it, so he still needed a hammer, and that weighed another 12 pounds. He was strong. He could lift 230 pounds. He could lift the hemlock tie with the hammer and puller lashed to it and hoist it to his shoulder. But how many miles could he carry it? Unloading the tie from the wagon, it felt even heavier than he had imagined. Thank God it hadn't been creosoted in coal tar distillates. The wood would have absorbed another 30 pounds of the dark liquid. The wrecker leaned the tie against a telegraph pole and roped the spike puller and hammer to it. Then he drove the trader's wagon behind some trees a short distance from the tracks. He shot both mules with his derringer, pressing the muzzle to their skulls to muffle the reports in case a patrol was nearby. He hurried back to the tracks, crouched and tilted the massive weight onto his shoulder. Then he straightened his legs and started walking. The rough wood dug through his coat, and he regretted not taking a blanket from the wagon to cushion his shoulder. The pain started as a dull ache. It sharpened quickly, biting deep. It cut into the muscle of his shoulder and ground against the bone. After only half a mile, it burned like fire. Should he put it down, run back to the wagon and get a blanket? But then Bell's patrols could find it lying by the rails. The wrecker's legs were tired already. His knees began to shake. But his shaking knees and the awful pain in his shoulder were soon forgotten as the weight compressed the bones in his spine, squeezing nerves. The nerves radiated a burning sensation into his legs, shooting sharp pains through his thighs and calves. He wondered if he put the tie down and stopped to rest whether he could lift it again. While he debated the risk, the decision was made for him. He had carried the tie for a mile when he saw a creamy glow in the sky up ahead. It brightened quickly. A locomotive headlamp, he realized, coming fast. Already he could hear it over the sound of his labored breathing. He had to get off the tracks. There were trees close by. Feeling his way in the dark, he descended the slope of the roadbed and careened through them. The headlamp threw crazy beams and shadows. He pushed in deeper, then knelt down carefully, tipping the massive crosstie down until its end rested on the ground. The relief of having the weight off him was an almost overwhelming pleasure. He leaned the other end of the tie against a tree. Then he sagged to the ground and stretched out on the pine needles to rest. The locomotive grew louder and roared past, drawing a train that rattled with the peculiar higher pitch of empty cars. It passed too quickly. Too soon he had to stand up, tip the crushing weight onto his shoulder, and struggle up the slope to the rails. The heel of his boot caught on the head of the rail as he tried to step between the tracks. He felt himself pitching forward, falling face first. He fought to regain his balance. But before he could get his feet under him in the headlong rush, the weight pushed him down. He twisted frantically to get out from under the tie. But the weight was too massive to escape entirely. A sledgehammer blow crushed his arm, and he cried out in pain.
Face down on the roadbed, he wrenched his arm out from under the tie, knelt as if in prayer, heaved it onto his aching shoulder, stood up, and pressed on. He tried to count his steps, but kept losing track. He had 5 miles to go, but he had no idea how far he had staggered. He started counting ties. His heart sank. There were almost 3,000 ties for every mile of track. After 100, he thought he would die. After 500, he was almost destroyed by the realization that 500 ties was no more than a fifth of a mile. His mind began to scatter. He imagined carrying the tie all the way to Tunnel 13, through the Stone Mountain, all the way to the Cascade Canyon Bridge. I'm the hero engineer. Giddy-headed laughter dissolved into a sob of pain. He felt himself drifting out of control. He had to shift his thoughts away from the pain and the fear that he could not continue. He drove his mind toward his early rote training in mathematics and engineering. Structure, the physics that made a bridge stand or fall. Struts, ties, foundation piers, cantilever arms, anchor arms, live loads, dead loads. The laws of physics ruled how to distribute weight. The laws of physics said he could not carry the cross tie another foot. He drove that madness from his mind and concentrated instead on fencing moves, the light, airy motion of a sword. Attack, he said aloud. Beat. Lunge. Parry. Riposte. Feint. Double feint. On, he plotted, the weight pounding his bones to jelly. Attack. Beat. Lunge. Parry. German intruded. Suddenly he was mumbling the engineering terms from his student days, then shouting the language of Heidelberg when he learned to kill.
Angriff. Batutangriff. Ausfall. Parade. Doppelfinte.
He imagined someone humming in his ear. Attack. Angriff. Beat. Batutangriff. Lunge. Ausfall. Parry. Parade. Double feint. Doppelfinte. Someone he could not see was humming a tuneless ditty. It grew shrill. Now he heard it right behind him. He whirled around, the weight of the cross tie nearly spinning him off his feet. Harsh acetylene light blazed on the tracks. It was a police patrol pumping along on an almost silent handcar. A sheer rock wall pressed against the right-of-way on his left. To his right, the mountain dropped sharply. He sensed more than saw a steep drop. The feathery tops of small trees piercing the dark indicated it could be as much as 20 feet down. He had no choice. The handcar was almost on top of him. He dropped the tie over the edge and jumped after it. He heard the tie hit a tree and snap the trunk. Then he smashed into a springy tree, knocking the wind out of him. The humming dropped in tone. The handcar was slowing down. To his horror, they stopped. He could hear men talking 15 feet above his head and saw beams of flashlights and lanterns. They dismounted. He could hear their boots crunching on the ballast as they strode the rail bed, shining their lights. A man shouted. Abruptly as they had appeared, they left. The handcar creaked into motion and hummed away, leaving him 15 feet down the steep embankment in the dark. Moving cautiously, hunched over on the slope, digging his boots in, he felt in the dark for the cross tie. He smelled pine pitch and traced the odor to the broken tree. Several feet down, he bumped into the square end of the tie. He felt for his tools. Still tied on. He looked up the slope. The rim of the rail bed towered above him. How would he climb up it, carrying the tie? He tipped it on one end, worked his shoulder under it, and struggled to stand. Every mile he had come so far, every escape meant nothing. This was the real test, to climb back up the embankment. It was only 20 feet, but each foot could have been a mile. the combination of the weight he was carrying and the distance he had come and the steepness of the embankment seemed insurmountable. As his strength failed, he saw his dreams of wealth and power fading before his eyes. He slipped and fell, then struggled to his feet again. If only he had killed Isaac Bell. He began to realize that he was battling Bell more than the tie, more than the cutoff, more than the Southern Pacific. The nightmare of Bell stopping him gave him the strength to rise, inch by inch, foot by foot. Attack. Angriff. Beat. Batutangriff. Lunge. Ausfall. Parry. Parade. Double feint. Doppelfinte. Twice he fell. Twice he got up. He reached to the top and staggered on. If he lived to be 90, he would never forget that gut-wrenching climb. The pounding of his heart was growing louder and louder, so loud that he eventually realized it couldn't be his heart. A locomotive? He stopped dead in the middle of the tracks, stunned and dismayed. Not another patrol. Thunder? Lightning flickered. He was hearing the rumble of thunder. Cold rain began to fall. He had lost his hat. Rainwater streamed down his face. The wrecker laughed. The rain would drench the patrols, chase them indoors. He laughed deliriously. Rain instead of snow. The rivers were rising, but the tracks would not be blocked by snow. Osgood Hennessy must be delighted. So much for the experts predicting an early winter. The railroad president had given up on the meteorologists and had actually paid an Indian medicine man to predict the weather, and he told Hennessy that the snows would come late this year. Rain instead of snow meant more time to complete the cutoff. The wrecker steadied the tie on his shoulder and spoke aloud. Never. A huge bolt of lightning lit everything stark white. The tracks curved sharply, clinging to the narrow cut. Below was a dizzying view of a rampaging river at the bottom of a deep canyon. This was the spot. The wrecker dropped the hemlock tie, loosened the ropes that held his tools, and pried up the spikes on both sides of an existing tie and set them carefully aside. Then he scrabbled at the crushed rock with the spike puller, loosening the sharp stones. He raked them out from under the tie and spread them carefully so they didn't roll down the embankment. When he had dug the ballast away, he used the puller as a lever to work the tie out from under the rails. Then he shoved his hemlock tie with a dynamite in it into the space and began scooping back the stone ballast, packing it under the tie. Last, he hammered in the 8 spikes. With the tie securely under the rails and the ballast carefully spread, he attached the trigger, a nail wedged under the rail into a hole drilled in the tie. The nail rested in the wood an inch above a fulminate mercury detonator. He had calculated carefully, driving 100 nails to measure the force so that a patrol walking the ties or a handcar rolling on the rails would not press the nail deeply enough to detonate the explosive. Only the full weight of a locomotive could trigger the detonator. One last brutal task remained. He tied his tools to the cross tie he had removed, tipped it onto his shoulder, and rose on shaking legs. He staggered a quarter mile from the trap he had laid and heaved tie and tools down the cliff where no patrol could see it. He was reeling with exhaustion, but his heart set with icy resolve. He had crippled the cutoff with dynamite, collision, and fire. He had shaken the mighty Southern Pacific by derailing the coastline limited. So what if Bell had twisted his New York attack to Hennessy's advantage? The wrecker raised his face to the storming sky and let the rain cleanse him. Thunder pealed. "It is mine," he roared back. "Tonight I earned it." He would win this final round. Not one man on the work train would survive to finish Tunnel 13.